This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 255, was recorded on January 21st, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by SS&C EZ, delivering cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to optimize operational and investment alpha across the entire investment process. After more than doubling in price in recent weeks, Bitcoin is pulling back a bit this week, trading just over $31,000 on Thursday afternoon as we record this episode. So we're finally going to cave to the many listeners who have been pleading with us to do an episode on Bitcoin and where it's headed. Logica Fund's co-founder and chief strategist Mike Green returns to discuss the digital currency revolution generally and Bitcoin specifically in this week's feature interview. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment, where we'll weigh in with an update on my own reactions to Mike Green and my own views on Bitcoin and the digital currency revolution, and then we'll take on another of Patrick's famous post-game chart decks, this week titled Exuberant Markets.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into this S&P 500 because we started this week just with a big blast off to the upside. We are trading at 3850 at the time of recording. And it really looks like the bulls want to really just find one more level higher, particularly breakouts in a number of these FANG stocks. What's your take here? Is there more upside on this S&P 500?
I think there is, and I don't think it's just one more level higher that the bulls are after. I don't think it's based on healthy economic fundamentals. I think it's a crack-up boom. And on one hand, there has been a very, very persuasive case made by Jeremy Grantham and others saying, hey, we're just way overdue for an overvalued market to reverse. The thing is, we've got completely unprecedented, new, uncharted territory of fiscal stimulus. Janet Yellen in her confirmation hearings this week saying, hey, baby, bigger is better. Let's really figure out how to pump this thing up. You know, they print enough money, they print enough bonds and print the money to buy them with. They can hold interest rates low, they can make money cheap, and they can drive that money into asset markets. So as much as I think it's a dangerous game because of the longer-term inflation risks that are involved, for the moment, I think things are just pushing higher.
All right. Well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar because it really has been quiet. I mean, we're right now pretty much trading right at the 90 handle. And really, it's the same price level where we were back in late November, early December. I mean, what's the next move for the dollar in your mind?
Well, the chart looks to me as though maybe this bounce off of key support is ending. It's too early to tell, though. I think the key is to watch whether or not we break to fresh lows on the dollar index. And if so, maybe it's the beginning of a move much lower. But frankly, in order to really confirm a reversal of trend to the upside, we'd need to see a series of higher highs and higher lows, and we don't have that yet. So I think it's early to tell, but my leaning is towards maybe the bounce is ending.
All right, Eric, let's get to crude oil. We're trading at $53. The trend has been pretty distinctly higher. And we had a little bit of a pullback, but the bulls seem to be dragging right back to the top end of that range where it was trading late last week. Is there more upside on oil in your mind?
Well, the key resistance here is the 200-week moving average at 53.68 on the March contract for WTI crude futures. And that's been tested three times now, on January 12th, January 14th, and then yesterday, January 20th. We need a decisive break above that layer to really green light the next significant move higher. And I do think that we're headed by summertime back up to, you know, probably $60 plus, maybe $65 even by March. midsummer. The thing is that, boy, the market has come up so far so quickly. There's a lot of reasons to make an argument for a technical correction or at least a pause here. And, you know, it seems like for now, three pretty good attempts so far have been rejected at the 200-week moving average. Let's see if we get a close over that. But frankly, in order for there to be a new downtrend, we'd need to get at least past the 21-day moving average at 50 spot 49, and we're quite a ways above that now. I'm leaning toward thinking that maybe an upside breakout is in the cards, and if so, I think we could move up pretty quickly from there to those previous highs around $56 or so. But the 53 spot 68 is going to be the key resistance. There is no inventory data to report this week. Crude oil inventories from EIA were delayed until Friday because of the combination of Monday's holiday and Wednesday's inauguration.
All right, Eric, let's touch on gold here. I mean, we had some pretty heavy selling for 2 weeks straight, and it seems like we found a little bit of support near that 200-day moving average, a little bit of reversal. We're back to about 1868 on the gold futures contract. Do you think that's it for the selling for gold, or do you think there could be a little bit more downside?
Well, Patrick, I think that it's very possible that we could see a new uptrend just starting now that could have some legs to it. And that would be if Bitcoin is going to correct further lower. Where we are right now on Thursday afternoon, Bitcoin has pulled back considerably from where it peaked at, what was it, 42,000 or just below 42,000. We were fully $10,000 per coin lower than that at below 32,000 earlier today, I think. And now we're back up as we're speaking to, what, 32.56 in there somewhere. A lot of volatility. We haven't quite broken down below that key level at 32,000. We did on an intraday basis, but we haven't actually closed below that level. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not we do. Let's wait till the post-game segment when we can get back to a chart on Bitcoin. But there's a few things going on there that suggest to me maybe the at least short-term top is in. We'll see what happens. In any event, if there is a short-term topping event going on in Bitcoin, well, it's time to test my hypothesis that I've been talking about for weeks, which is I've been thinking that what's holding gold back is Bitcoin taking the market share, so to speak. If Bitcoin is going to have a pause here and is not going to resume its exuberant rally fairly immediately, that could be exactly what's needed in order to ignite the next significant rally in gold, that seesaw that I talked about in previous week's episodes. Let's see if that happens, but of course, the jury's still out on what Bitcoin is going to do next. So I think we need to see confirmation that Bitcoin really is entering a correction phase, and if it does, we'll find out whether or not that's the catalyst to take gold higher.
All right, well, let's finally touch on the 10-year Treasury yield because, I mean, we had the big breakout and we saw the yields pressing toward 120 last week. And really, we've been consolidating since. Is this just like a little consolidation before yields head higher? What's your take on the continuation of this trend?
I doubt it. I mean, from a technical standpoint, you could look at the chart and conclude that it's temporary, you know, catching a breath before moving higher in a continuation pattern. I doubt that's going to be the case because I think what pushed yields higher was the, oh my gosh, look at all this deficit spending that's planned. That means they're going to have to just flood the Treasury market with all kinds of new issuance of Treasury bonds. That's going to crash the market. And of course, the next part that they didn't really consider is, yeah, but what is the Fed going to do in terms of stepping in to buy a lot of that new issuance? If you listen to Janet Yellen in her confirmation hearings, and of course now she's Treasury instead of the Fed, but it just seems like they're all on their game. They're talking about stimulus, Fed balance sheet expansion, buying more Treasuries. I think that what we're likely to see is actually a return back toward sub 1% yields. That's my leaning, but frankly, I don't have really strong conviction on that. Certainly, there is reason to think that the deficit spending is going to dump a whole lot of treasuries in the market. I just don't think the market has to absorb them. I think the Fed is going to absorb most of them. We'll see what happens.
This week's feature interview guest is Logica Fund's chief strategist, Mike Green. Eric, why did we invite Mike back on the show this week?
Well, Mike has wanted to talk about Bitcoin on Macro Voices. When I had him recently on Smarter Markets, he said, when can I do a Bitcoin conversation? And it was just as we had several listeners hitting us up for a Bitcoin conversation. So it was just a confluence of Mike wanting to talk Bitcoin and a lot of listeners asking us to do a Bitcoin show, and we decided to give it a shot.
Well, Eric's interview with Mike Green is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abaxx Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how the markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with Neo Stock Exchange founder Josh Schmidt is available now at smartermarketspod.com. My guest on Smarter Markets this coming Saturday morning will be commodity legend Mark Fisher, who's literally been trading commodity futures markets for decades. We'll be discussing everything from how Mark uses the Hudson River as a risk management tool to the future of commodity trading exchanges, what needs to change, what could be improved, and what unfair advantages exist for some traders versus others. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this free new podcast.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Logica Funds partner and chief strategist, Mike Green. Mike, it's great to have you back on the program. I want to talk about the digital currency revolution that I predicted in my book 2 years ago. And actually, I'd like to expand that because I don't think it's just a digital currency revolution. I think we eventually get to where currencies are digital and also where we have a fully tokenized financial system, meaning that stock markets, commodity markets, real estate markets, registries of deeds, everything eventually, I think, is tokenized. And that's not next week or next month. That's over the next 25 years. I predict that's what happens. Do you agree with that general view? And with respect to digital currencies, is it just one great big global digital currency, or is it lots of different digital currencies that make up the future economy?
So I share your view that we are unquestionably heading towards some type of a digital series of currencies and that almost all securities are heading in the same direction. We already have elements of that, as you know, and for those who think about the difference between a gold coin and a dollar bill, right, that serial number on a dollar bill is kind of the first attempt at digitizing. It's the first attempt at trying to create an audit trail. We have very few features that track that unless it makes its way through the banking system, and so we can see that. But I don't think there's any question that we will embed greater power and flexibility into the currencies going forward. And the easiest way to do that is to move to the digital realm. If I think about the importance of that, or like what that could mean, for example, there's a wide variety of ways it can be used. It can be used in a, it can be used in a manner that creates greater restrictions, right? Effectively creates the Chinese social credit type dynamic where every piece of currency can be tracked. But we could also choose not to do that. And that's actually part of the reason why I wanted to come on and speak about this, because I do think that we are broadly missing an opportunity to have an informed discussion around what are the choices that we make as we go through this process.
I couldn't agree more with that, but before we even get there, I want to start with digital currency itself, because you'll hear a lot of people who don't understand this will say, look, what's all this talk about digital currency? The financial system's been digital for 30 years. And I think that those people are mistaking digital or computerized accounting systems, which keep track of conventional currency, which is anything but digital, with this new innovation. And we have to credit the inventors of Bitcoin for this breakthrough in both computer science and in finance of inventing secure digital bearer assets that allow the actual title and ownership of an asset to be conveyed electronically through a computer network. We didn't have that 15 years ago. It didn't exist. Now it does, and we're just starting to get our heads around what that means. I think where you're headed is, boy, we really ought to be having some public discussion about how to embrace this technology for the benefit of society. Before we even get to that, let's just talk about what the benefit is of having secure digital bearer asset-based currency as opposed to just using digital accounting systems to keep track of fiat currency that we've been doing for the last 30 years. What's the significance of that difference? Why is it important?
Well, among other things, it allows you to break from just the traditional financial system itself, right? So the way that we have tried to digitize or create these accounting systems are inherently built around the limitations of a non-digital currency. If I deposit a dollar into my local bank, the only way I can have access to that via an ATM is through the accounting systems and records associated with that banking system. So if my bank systems are down and the ATM cannot verify, there are systems that might allow me to tap into credit, right? But ultimately, that system is broken unless my bank is able to respond with its accounting systems and say, yes, this is here. Right. When you talk about the innovation of Bitcoin, for example, what I would argue is that its primary innovation was in decentralizing that database so that everybody has a record of what I have, whether I can spend that digital dollar or digital Bitcoin. So that's, I would argue, is the single biggest criteria difference, is it takes away some of the scale advantages, for example, that exist in the traditional banking system, where JP Morgan is able to more efficiently offer those accounting systems and those credit approval systems simply by virtue of scale than my local bank. It changes that calculus quite dramatically.
Mike, I would just add my own perspective to that, which is there's a huge difference in terms of disintermediation and elimination of counterparty risk. If you wire $1 million into my bank account with XYZ Bank in New York City, what I've got is I, as an unsecured creditor of that bank, now have an additional $1 million in my account balance, which I can get out of that bank if they don't default, as long as everything goes my way and the bank doesn't fail in a colossal way where my, you know, at $1 million, it's well over the government insurance limit, so I would be potentially losing some money. Whereas if you send me electronically a transfer of digital currency for $1 million, I've got the cash. It's exactly as if you handed me $1 million in, you know, freshly printed $100 bills. I've got it. Once I'm in possession of it, I don't have to worry about any counterparty. So it's almost like holding physical gold, because when you hold physical fiat currency, you still have a counterparty, which is the government. When you hold gold, you don't have a counterparty. And I would argue that when you hold a digital currency, which everyone universally agrees has value, and we're not at that point yet, because there's a lot of people that think that, you know, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have value. A lot of people think that they'll eventually go to zero or be outlawed or what have you. When we eventually get to the point where there is widespread and uniform agreement and acceptance that one or more digital currencies have purchasing power and value and store of value capability, then we can eliminate all kinds of counterparty risks, disintermediate, eliminate the middlemen, and the financial system just gets much better. Now, here's the crazy thing about how this is going down, as I think a bizarre manifestation of the fact that it was the inventors of Bitcoin who deserve credit for inventing the technology needed to make possible digital bearer instruments. What we have is there is no conversation going on about how to adopt that technology and how it should be best adopted to benefit society and improve the financial system. Instead, you've got what curiously seems to be almost a generational divide based on age. Older investors just tend to have this attitude of, I don't believe in all this crypto, whatever it is stuff. I'm going to ignore it. It's not real money. And then you've got very, very, I would call them zealots almost in the Bitcoin community, the so-called Bitcoin maximalists, who are absolutely convinced that if there is going to be a future where digital currency systems are the center of the financial system, well, then surely, since Bitcoin is where it all got invented, then it just has to be Bitcoin that becomes that currency. Let's start with whether or not that is a smart assumption, the people who assume it has to be Bitcoin, but then move on to, okay, if you don't have that assumption, how come we're not having the public discussion or discourse about how we should adopt this technology?
Well, I there's a lot to unpack there. First, your addition to my point in terms of the elimination of the credit risk, right? The way that we have chosen to do that to this point is, as I'd highlighted, is through economies of scale, right? So if I'm going to send $1 million or I'm going to send $1 billion, I want to deal with a large counterparty to whom that is a small risk. I wouldn't use the local bank, right? So it's driven consolidation of the banking system in the same way I was referring to before. Your point about the dynamic of older versus younger investors, and I would remove the word investors, right? Because I don't think that there's an awful lot of investment that's happening in this space yet, outside of the venture capital investments that are occurring around the components of decentralized finance and some of the innovative processes that are that people are attempting to recreate the traditional financial system that, again, is predicated on this economy of scale and addressing things like counterparty risk and the cost through economies of scale. Many could argue that those have created diseconomies of scale on a social basis now, which is part of the reason I think this is an important discussion. When you talk about investment as distinct from speculation, that's where I think we actually have to kind of draw the line. I think there's an awful lot of people in Bitcoin who are speculating that, like other Silicon Valley type inventions, and we have no idea whether Bitcoin came out of Silicon Valley or whether it came out of, you know, a Chinese viral lab. The reality is that that is speculation. We don't know if Bitcoin is going to be the solution. We don't know if Ethereum is going to be the solution or any of the other tokens that are out there. People are speculating as to their value. And I think that's a really important distinction to make, right? When we look at something like Bitcoin, there's a very excited group who adopts the kind of Bitcoin maximalist approach that says, if we make it large enough, then they have to accept it. It can't be shut down. And they have some evidence for that. The models that have functionally broken the laws and grown to a certain size have been allowed to flourish. And so, you know, we can point to Netflix and Twitter and Facebook becoming communications companies, YouTube becoming a communications company without seeking communications licenses, growing to a scale that it would be unthinkable for the most part to shut them down. Same thing happening with Uber and Lyft in transportation, where they have grown to a size that it became, quote unquote, unthinkable to shut them down, even though they were very clearly in violation of the regulations that were required to obtain taxi medallions or various other components. Airbnb in the lodging industry is unlicensed lodging and has grown large enough that it is, quote unquote, unthinkable to shut it down. That fundamentally is the Bitcoin maximalist argument, that if it becomes large enough, that the authorities will be unwilling to shut it down because of the public outcry. I think, you know, as I said, there's evidence to support that, but I do think that money is actually a very different construct. Because while a local government can benefit from the dynamics associated with the sale of taxi medallions and can benefit from the revenues associated with that, it's really only when you get to the state level that you start to deal with the consequences of attempting to disintermediate the state from money. I don't think it's the same calculus.
Mike, as you say, the Bitcoin movement has gained a huge amount of momentum. And one of the things I said in my book is, although I predict that Bitcoin will be outlawed because, frankly, it does pose a very serious threat to government's monopoly on the issuance of money, and therefore it is very much in the interest of government to outlaw it. When it gets to a certain point, when it gets to the point where there's significant institutional adoption, it becomes politically inexpedient to outlaw it. I think 2021 is going to be the year that this comes to a head. I think by the end of 2021, either there are major, you know, concerted efforts by governments all around the world to dramatically regulate and potentially completely outlaw Bitcoin and other privately minted cryptocurrencies, or we get to a point where it really has become impossible to outlaw them. And if that happens, then I would predict that the distinction they put on it is they say, okay, look, these crypto assets are not money. Only the government can issue money. If you want to have your crypto assets, you can have them. But as soon as they start to behave like money or are used like money, that's the part that we're not going to allow. Because I just don't see how governments are going to stand by and say, oh, some really smart guys invented this cool thing that really is very innovative and really smart. And so therefore, we're just going to give up our monopoly over the issuance of money and let these guys that invented Bitcoin be in charge of issuing money for the entire planet and its financial system. That's just crazy to me. So how do you see this playing out? I just described what I see is kind of a conundrum that I think has to resolve in some ways by the end of the year, but I don't ever see it going to the point where governments just say, okay, well, we missed our chance to be in charge of money. Now Bitcoin's in charge of money. We're going to stand down and just adopt Bitcoin to run our economies on. I don't think that ever happens. How do you see this playing out?
As you know, I actually am incredibly skeptical on Bitcoin. I think that one of the wonderful things about it is that it is the proverbial all things to all people. It is a mirror that reflects what you want to see in it, right? So some descriptions are it is a commodity that has extraordinarily low storage and transportation costs. Some descriptions are that it is money. Some is that it's a store of wealth that magically makes you money. So to me, I think one of the underlying features of Bitcoin is this idea that it has survived. I don't think that's true. And I actually think that 2021 is going to be a year in which we discover that what we think is today Bitcoin is actually not Bitcoin. And I know that sounds cryptic, and I'm not prepared to reveal a lot of the work that I've done in this area. But I do think that the general theory that Bitcoin is going to evade the response from the U.S. government for long enough for it to become fully established is misplaced. And I would suggest that in the process of the enthusiasm for Bitcoin as a mechanism for protecting your quote-unquote wealth from the U.S. government or other major sovereigns, that one, you're opening, there's a very clear avenue open to attack, which is simply to declare that, fine, you want it to be a currency, Bitcoin's a currency. Therefore, taxes are no longer against a realized gain as you would have in a security. Your taxes have to be marked to market on an annual basis. And so if Bitcoin goes from 20,000 to 40,000, even if you didn't sell, you owe taxes on that difference. That at minimum, I think, is coming. And ironically, it's the worst nightmare for Bitcoin because it would create a tremendous supply of Bitcoin, particularly in the United States, that I would suggest the Bitcoin maximalists have underappreciated. I think the second thing is that this focus on Bitcoin and the idea of the separation of money from the state, which does not work in the simplest form. It's predicated on a failed Austrian view that there is some inherent intrinsic value to money, that money is the most marketable commodity. That dynamic, I think, is actually distracting us from the ability to have that deeper conversation about what features do we want in money? What is it important to us to have anonymity? Is it important to us to not have tracked what we purchase with that money? It's important to establish the ownership of that money, but what I do with it may not be the government's business. And there may be very valid reasons for that, but we're not having that discussion because we're so enthusiastically embracing the get rich quick dynamics of this store of value and taunting the no coiners with the have fun staying poor, that we're doing what we're doing in many other aspects of our society. We're shutting down the communication that allows us to engage in a discussion about what are our shared objectives and aspirations.
I think that right there is the most important point in this whole digital currency situation, Mike, and it's one that nobody's talking about, which is you've got people who are assuming that Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever, some cryptocurrency invented by people who have no governmental license or endorsement or approval to be coining money, they think their invention is going to become the new money that runs the whole global economy. And then you got people who are ignoring this this worthy revolution. And I think you and I agree there is a breakthrough here that warrants a revolution in a redesign of the way that money itself works. I think this is bigger than the internet. I think it's bigger than the personal computer. I think it is a massive change. But what's going on right now is we've got the technology, and the people who understand it are not engaging in a public debate about how society broadly should adopt this. They're assuming that it's their place to go and try to invent their own currency system, which they'll push as becoming the new global currency or the center of the financial system to replace the U.S. dollar, because it sounds good to them to have that outcome. That's kind of crazy. So how do we get to an actual public discussion about how this technology should be adopted in order to advance the economy and the global financial system?
Well, I think part of the challenge is that we have ceded so much control to the technologists at this point, whether that's in the form of wealth or whether that is in the form of control of public discourse. I would simply highlight the deplatforming of Donald Trump as an example of that type of ceding of control, right? When we do that, we're engaged in a decision to suggest that some people have more merit in that discussion than others simply by virtue of the power and affluence that they have collected under the current regime. And, you know, if you glance back to Socrates, for example, or dig yourself deep into philosophy, you know, the theory under Socrates and Plato's Republic was the idea that the philosophers should actually be the governors, right? Well, you know, At Jack is not a philosopher. He certainly may fancy himself one, right? And we've got lots of pseudo-philosophers that operate throughout our society at this point that drop down from the mountain and bestow us with their wisdom. But the reality is that we are not having a conversation about what we want as a society. We've effectively ceded that discussion to a subsegment of our population. And that focus on the technology, I think, exposes us to extraordinary risks in terms of how it moves forward, right? It directs our society towards one that is functionally corporatist. It directs us to a society that is inherently lacking in empathy and understanding of the needs of the average citizen. We need to involve the lawyers. We need to involve the philosophers. We need to actually have this discussion in the same form of framework that we would have had it in the negotiations around the U.S. Constitution. What do we actually want? That was what was unique about the United States, was that it was founded during a period of the Enlightenment in which those discussions were hammered out. You know, you and I had the discussion, what is really needed is a series of Federalist Papers. The idea that we're going to have a brilliant exposition of how things can be, and that that can be brought into the public debate as we discuss things like digital currency. And it's not easy, because there are features of digital currency that seem at their core inherently good, right? Should we be able to track all purchases because we want to make sure that we can capture the criminals in our society? Absolutely. Right? That sounds like a great idea, until you realize that that feature also may prevent American citizens from making purchases that might be frowned upon, right? So, and cause them to make purchases that display virtue. So do suddenly we see an increase in tithing and giving to churches because we are concerned that the government is watching what we're doing? That sends a false signal to the markets, right? The price of church goes up. Price of alcohol or drugs go down, right? Now, those could be viewed as good, but as a society, we should have that conversation.
Mike, what we are seeing very clearly is governments are responding, sort of kind of responding. They're definitely engaging in the design and, in some cases, the deployment and rollout of CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. And it seems like, to my own dismay, they're focused on the need that I think they correctly identify to figure out how they're going to participate as central banks to issue digital currency. They got that part right. But they're not engaging with the crypto community to learn anything from what the crypto guys have figured out, or at least not very much. And they're certainly not staging a public discussion to invite a public discourse about how this should work and what degree of privacy we should trade off for security. You know, this the way Bitcoin was designed was to eliminate most government controls and prevent governments from being able to monitor and oversee private financial transactions. As you've said, there's an argument that goes the other way. When do we get to the point where the public has a say in this and we the people get to decide what we want our new digital money system to look like? I don't hear the Bitcoin crowd being the slightest bit open to considering the needs of what it would take to have governments actually endorse what they see in Bitcoin as the future of money. And I don't see central banks really extending any kind of interest in what the public wants in terms of how these trade-offs between privacy and security are made. When do we get our say?
Well, I think that's ultimately a big part of the challenge, and it's one of the reasons why you're hearing me raise my voice with increasing stridency around this. Right? This is similar to the dynamics, for those who have heard me talk about the active manager versus passive manager dynamic. Vanguard and BlackRock now spend more lobbying the U.S. government individually than the rest of the industry does in total. And as a result, you know, similar to a Cantillon type effect, they have access to the government first. They control the dialogue. I would suggest the same thing's happening, you know, with the Facebooks, Googles, et cetera, of the world. It is presumed that because they have the most engineers and because they have exhibited success, that they have the best vision and the best capability to deliver on this. You know, I've even heard people suggest that, oh, you know, Google should build a cryptographic currency that can then be licensed to governments around the world, right? These are patently absurd ideas. What we need to actually do is start to raise our voices into a dialogue that allow us to do that. And as I said, you know, the Federalist Papers allowed us to do that by publishing into the common domain insights and thoughts on the structure of the Constitution and the government that allowed the population and the public to think about how to elect their representatives to the Constitutional Convention. Right? It turns it into a negotiation and a discussion. As we exist in America today, and America is ultimately going to set these standards, it's unrealistic to think that it's going to happen elsewhere. As it exists in the United States today, I would suggest that those conversations are largely captured by the technological elite, the academic institutions, and the focus is not on the features that would be valuable to the construction of growth and independence and price formation. It's being focused on the idea of how do we take a banking system and convert that directly into a digital currency, embedding things like KYC into the currency itself. Right now, that creates a really interesting type of question, right? So KYC stands for Know Your Customer, right? It's the reason why we have this within the banking system is that the banking system has a unique characteristic. It can multiply money, right? It can take the currency that is created by the state and under license, it can expand that. When we talk about trying to embed those characteristics into the currency itself, I think we're making a mistake. Right now, again, that's just my voice, but the banking institutions do play a role, right? The ability to make credit-based expansion. I'm going to, as a banking principal, extend risk of my institution by taking capital and lending it to another individual, creating deposits and expanding the money supply in that manner, right? That is hugely valuable as long as it is done well and it is done with responsibility. But when we try to take that away and we embed it in the currency, what we're effectively doing is taking all the knowledge of how the use of proceeds and handing it back to the state. And there's a reason why it should be separated. There's a reason why currencies, as I indicated, or spending, and you highlighted this idea of the digital bearer asset, right? The anonymity around that is hugely valuable. It helps in the formation and the efficient processing of capital that people don't necessarily need to know who is doing what. They just need to see the price signals and volume signals that allow the aggregation of that information. The only way I think this happens is for individuals to begin to raise their voices, vote better, put in place elected representatives that actually are considerate of this and not purely subject to the corporate lobby.
Let's talk about what's going on in the Bitcoin space, particularly with respect to institutional adoption, because I think you and I see this very similarly. We both agree that there needs to be a digital currency revolution. We need to move off of paper money to digital money in digital bearer asset, tokenized, cleared on a distributed ledger kind of technology, the stuff that was invented by Bitcoin. You and I have both agreed that there's lots of reasons we think that Bitcoin as a private invention, which was designed with features that were intentionally conceived in order to offend governments, in order to make it much more difficult for governments to trace financial transactions and so forth. We thought that that would not be successful and that CBDCs, or what I call SVDCs, Silicon Valley companies designing digital currency systems, but not for the purpose of selling them or making them appeal to the same libertarian crowd that loves Bitcoin, but rather designing them for the purpose of selling them to the central bankers, saying, look, we've designed the technology so that you can create your central bank digital currency using our Google Bucks or Apple Bucks or, you know, whatever the technology is. It seemed to me like Facebook's Libra project was potentially the first Silicon Valley digital currency. It's kind of flopped, at least temporarily, but I think it will be resurrected, and I think other companies will do that. But you know what? In the meantime, Mike, we see big institutions buying into Bitcoin in size. It's not just, you know, guys that are speculating, retail guys buying a few bitcoins to see what happens. We see major corporations putting tens or hundreds of millions of dollars into Bitcoin positions as a store of value. We see major financial institutions taking big positions in Bitcoin. These are people that are smart enough to understand the hesitations that both you and I have expressed about why Bitcoin is not likely to ever become the center of the financial system. They're people who did hesitate to invest in it for years because they had that understanding. But just in the last year or so, they've started buying in size. What the heck is going on?
Well, I think in simple terms that the participation of large financial institutions or financial speculators, and we tend to presume that they have quote unquote done the work. My experience, I mean, as you know, the way that I approach things is a little bit different. I tend to look deeply into the market structure to understand why something is behaving. I think about a market as a series of transactions, which ultimately represents a series of constraints as compared to some form of information. The institutional space is by and large doing an analysis of Bitcoin where they look at the price behavior that is exhibited historically, that it is largely an uncorrelated asset that has risen sharply. And they presume that the information contained in that history of prices suggests that Bitcoin has value. Within a portfolio construct, they're doing nothing differently than they would if they were looking at any individual company or ETF and saying, okay, this seems to have value in terms of a diversifying component associated with our portfolio. In the case of a security like Coca-Cola, there may be some perfunctory analysis around, you know, what does their 10K say? What does the management team say, et cetera? But they certainly aren't digging in and trying to understand the formula of Coca-Cola. They're not trying to understand, you know, doing their own independent research on the acceptability of sugared drinks or caffeinated drinks, et cetera. So the level of research, I think people tend to underappreciate how little research is done in these decisions. And I would just highlight, you know, people's excitement around things like Paul Tudor Jones putting a small amount of money into it, or MFS putting $100 million into it, right? MFS is an institution with, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 billion in assets. For them to put $100 million into something is really the equivalent of you and I buying a $2 lottery ticket. And that sounds insane, but that is pretty darn close to the level of scrutiny that I would suggest that it came through. The flow of money into this space, I think, increasingly is taking on the character of, once you do your homework, then you'll understand. And your homework consists of talking to somebody else who you think did their homework and speaking to somebody else who you think did their homework. And I realize how offensive that can sound to people in the industry who work very hard and think that they do a good job. But the simple reality is that very little due diligence is being done in this space. And unfortunately, the involvement of institutions creates a self-fulfilling component. It's very similar to something that we spoke about, or we wrote about in a paper from Logica called Policy in a Time of Pandemics, Social Media, and Passive Investing, where it's presumed that the price going up is evidence of the validation of something like Bitcoin. And I would just suggest that right now we're caught in the speculative mania where people are moving assets into Bitcoin under the expectation that it has asymmetric payoff, similar to a St. Petersburg type paradox, where what price do you put on something that affect that potentially has a small probability of an infinite valuation, right? So an infinite valuation of something, even if it's at a very small probability, implies an infinite valuation of the asset itself. That's not right, but it is a way of thinking about it. And I would argue that that's what people are doing.
That's actually very consistent with my view, Mike, because I think what you're saying is they're looking at this, institutions are saying, look, this whatever it is thing, Bitcoin, whatever you want to say about it, it's gaining lots and lots of capital. It whatever it is, people are investing in it, and we don't want to be left out. We want to be part of it. I don't think that analysis, I don't think that the purchase of Bitcoin that most of these institutions are engaging in is based on a contemplation of, number one, there needs to be a digital currency revolution where we replace paper fiat currency with digital currency. And number two, I think that Bitcoin is going to win the contest and it's not going to be CBDCs, it's going to be Bitcoin. I don't think that analysis is occurring in the minds of institutions. It's occurring in the minds of Bitcoin maximalists who are investing or speculating, I should say, with retail-sized capital flows. And that's driving, you know, what I think is a fantasy about Bitcoin is going to replace the US dollar at the center of the global financial system. I don't think that ever comes true. But I also don't think that the institutional investors who are buying Bitcoin believe that that's even a consideration. Do you think that they're buying Bitcoin because they think it might be the replacement for the US dollar? Or is it just because it's something that for whatever reason seems to have a lot of capital flowing into it? Let's play this momentum trade and make a buck on it while it's working.
Oh, I think unquestionably it's the latter, right? Now, there are any of those portfolio managers that are making that choice will have analysts that are effectively Bitcoin maximalists, right? And those Bitcoin maximalists that work for them will fervently believe that their boss's choice to allocate some capital to this idea that they have presented as having this infinite upside is evidence of their boss's belief. But having done this for a very long time, I can assure you that their bosses will flip on a heartbeat if it moves in the opposite direction. And by the way, the analysts will likely lose their job.
What I think is missing from all this is when do those big boys, the portfolio managers, wake up and recognize, hey, wait a minute, there really does need to be a digital currency revolution where we literally replace the entire planet's money system with digital currency systems that are not likely to be Bitcoin. They're likely to be something else. And that's a much more important trend that we need to start to get our heads around. I don't think that's even begun to start yet. Do you? And if so, to what extent has it started?
I agree with you. I don't think it has started. I also think that you are focusing on the wrong group for those insights. Right. Portfolio managers and macro investors are, for the most part, not currency theorists. Right. They are not even economics in and of itself. Right. Is largely an applied science as it's currently practiced, as compared to a deep theoretical science and a thoughtfulness about what do we want to accomplish as a society. Right. An economy, you've probably heard me say this before, is functionally just people doing favors for other people in exchange for tokens. What we incentivize and how we try to shape that economy, how we choose to allocate those resources, is largely assigned in most free market economies or free type market economies. It's assigned to the market to send those signals. And economics is the study of that. It's not the design of that system. And so, you know, and that's economics far before you get to finance, which is ultimately truly just applied economics, right? A combination of accounting and applied economics that is designed to profit from the system as it exists. None of these people are the people you should be turning to for the design of the system.
I'm not suggesting that we should be turning to them for the design of the system, but at some point, the financial community needs to recognize that a redesign of money itself is coming. It's necessary. It could arguably be described as slightly overdue because it's been more than a decade that the underlying technology has been known. And it's being adopted by a bunch of people who are so excited about it that they just can't help themselves and they think it's their place to coin their own money. And I just don't see that being the end solution. So how do we get to the point, and I think you're seeing it in decentralized finance, not in the currency space, but in other asset markets. Abaxx Technologies, a company I'm involved with, is using tokenization to modernize commodity futures markets. Other people are doing the same thing with stock markets. But in terms of the recognition that we need a tokenized currency system to replace paper fiat money for the whole planet. And I don't think it's necessarily one great big global currency. I think it's several different central bank issued or central bank endorsed digital currencies where the technology probably comes from Silicon Valley, but the actual issuer of the currency is a central bank. Nobody seems to really be thinking about that. And even I've talked to the IMF guys that were doing the study on central bank digital currency. And, you know, they don't even see the picture. The opportunity to design digital currency systems with radically enhanced monetary policy tools that go way beyond anything that we do now with monetary policy is such obvious low-hanging fruit opportunity that not a one of these central bank guys that's looking at digital currency technology has even woken up to the possibility of yet. How do we get to the point of getting the non-Bitcoin, you know, the Bitcoin guys, you got to give them credit. They've got the right vision. They just think that they can coin their own money, which I don't see happening. How do we get their passion somehow transfused into central bankers and people who are looking at these digital currency systems and get them to do something smart to design the right digital currency system of the future?
So, you know, I think you and I disagree a little bit on this. First, I would suggest the idea that this needs to come out of the private sector is a uniquely, you know, is a byproduct of you and I having grown to maturation in the aftermath of the Reagan Revolution, right? The idea that the government would license effectively a technology that is produced by Google or by Microsoft, in my view, is very deeply flawed. At the end of the day, what we're talking about is a system that needs to be built within this public sphere in an environment of public service, which is a longstanding principle of democratic governments. It's the idea behind serving in Congress. It's the idea behind being appointed to become an ambassador or being appointed to the National Security Advisory Committee. You need to separate your responsibility to the corporation to produce something that can be made profitable with something that can be produced for the benefit of the public, for the benefit of your fellow citizens. And I don't think that's possible within a corporate environment. So I actually disagree with the very simple view that this is going to come out of Silicon Valley. I think that the people that do it could come out of Silicon Valley, but I think it's a very different statement than saying it's going to come out of the corporations in Silicon Valley. The second thing that I would draw attention to in this framework is the idea that the central banks themselves have the capabilities and the skills, I would say that we're defaulting it to them. And again, by not putting it into the public sphere and not discussing what the features that we want, we naturally gravitate towards status solutions that result in increased surveillance, right? Effectively try to achieve the objectives of the state as stated in the simplest forms, right? I want to prevent crime. I want to use this to reduce the amount of nefarious influences that can be done. But there's often very little consideration. I think we see this explicitly in the behaviors of central banks. There's very little consideration of the unintended consequences of that. Again, very simply, if you make a currency truly traceable and transparent in terms of its uses, you are going to see citizens move to accommodate that. They will reduce their consumption of things that are frowned upon by the state, sending false price signals to the state for the supply of things that are perceived as virtuous within the state. And different states can have different views of what's virtuous and what's frowned upon, right? Russia has a very different view than I would hope the United States has. China would be an example of a society that has a radically different view of what should be encouraged and what should be frowned upon. And again, I think the design of the currency should reflect the objectives of the country. And that can only, in a democratic country, that can only be obtained by effectively putting it to the people and their elected representatives.
Okay, so far we've been talking about what needs to happen, what should happen in order to get to the eventual digital currency revolution that replaces government-issued money with new money that's digital and I think is probably government-issued. I think we agree on that point. Some people think it's, you know, Bitcoin takes over the world. Let's come back, though, to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, because I know a lot of our listeners are going to be focused on, okay, so, you know, what are you actually saying about Bitcoin? Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Are you bullish or are you bearish? Whether we agree or not, there's a lot of people who think that Bitcoin is on its way to becoming the digital currency system of the future that's going to take over the whole planet. And they think that the growth in Bitcoin is being driven by a growing recognition or belief system that Bitcoin does have a realistic chance of replacing government-issued currency as the center of the global financial system. Do you think that there is any truth whatsoever to that? And if not, well, okay, but what does that mean, considering that right now the price trend is very strongly up in Bitcoin and also in Ethereum and other cryptocurrencies? What do you tell people who are trading this stuff?
So I'll be very clear that I don't know what is going to happen to the price of Bitcoin, whether it goes to zero or whether it goes to 100,000, 500,000, 10 million. I have absolutely no idea. What I would suggest is that we tend to lump all of these things together without considering how they take their basic form. And, you know, I would describe Bitcoin as a speculative commodity that has a unique asset, a unique feature to it. It is the only commodity that can be produced from electricity alone. Right? That is its defining feature, that it is exactly the same thing as making aluminum. You just skip the bauxite. You dump a ton of electricity in and you get Bitcoin out. That Bitcoin can be stored or it can be sold for fiat. Those are your two choices. In the framework of storing it, we refer to it as a store of wealth. We call it digital gold. And that is predicated on a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of gold in financial systems. It is based on this Austrian framework that money has some inherent value associated with it. That's very far removed from the reality. Right? Money, as we think about it in terms of coinage, is simply an accounting system. It goes back to the beginning part of the discussion we were having about what is the difference between having digital and non-digital currency. Digital currency just makes that accounting system infinitely easier. And as a result, it loses many of the requirements of the features that we have. So serial numbers on dollar bills or coins that have ridged edges so that we can more accurately identify if people have shaved the edges of them, reducing the counterfeiting type dynamics. Right. But at its core, when we think about Bitcoin, to me, it's just a terrible commodity in the simplest form. Ethereum is something different. And I think it speaks to the broader decentralized finance and tokenization type dynamic. Ethereum is a base layer on which effectively contract law can be written. And the tools for editing and efficiently writing those contracts, I think, are inherently valuable. Right. Effectively, an Ethereum based smart contract can replace an S1 prospectus, it can replace a credit document, it can replace a mortgage application. What should be happening in Ethereum is, I think, a very different conversation than should be happening in Bitcoin. Bitcoin, it becomes a question of, does the commodity have value, and does the commodity, is the support for the commodity, does it in some way represent risk to the society and the state as it's currently constructed? And I think the answer to that is unequivocally, it represents extraordinary risks. And, you know, not to tease people, but I do think that we will discover that the reason that Bitcoin is shut down is surprisingly not simply because of the threat that it represents to the state's ability to tax, but because of an actual national security threat associated with it. And I unfortunately have to leave it at that. The dynamics around Ethereum, I think, speak to this broader issue of how should we be focusing our resources and involving people in building the tools that provide the very effective evaluation and auditing of those smart contracts within the construct of a legal system that exists within states, right? How do we escalate and effectively move away from the extraordinarily firm arbitration of a smart contract that delineates this is exactly what will happen to a common law or a judicial-based system in which we can have a discussion around, was this the intent of the parties? Did a hidden clause represent fraud? How do we identify those types of dynamics? And that, I think, is a very fruitful discussion to be having around the questions of decentralized finance, tokenization, smart contracts, et cetera. Bitcoin, I think, is, I mean, to me, it's certainly fascinating to watch the price adoption of it, but it's actually quite uninteresting.
Mike, as we close, our accredited investors know that you run a fund which is only available to accredited investors. They can contact you for information about investing. But I also know that you're working on a series of writings that are going to address not just digital currency, but everything from gold to digital currency to the role of the state in the issuance of money and so forth. As you alluded earlier, some of those things you're not ready to publish yet, but it's all coming, I believe, on your website. So please tell our listeners, where can they subscribe or tune in to make sure they don't miss that when it comes out?
Sure. You can sign up on our website at www.logicafunds.com. We have a tab that would allow you to sign up for the release of our white papers. We try to regularly publish on interesting, you know, thought dynamics, whether that's the components that have led to the underperformance of the value factor, to I referred to the dynamics of policy setting in a world of information being obscured by passive investing and other stuff. And, you know, this series has been one that is overdue for the very simple reason that as I began to think about the role of gold and began to focus on how to explain how, you know, I think about the role of gold in a financial system, it rapidly morphed into a much broader dynamic, trying to understand the Bitcoin phenomenon. And I'm excited to start getting this out there, but in the simplest form, like I want to always emphasize on this, that nothing that we put out is investment advice. It's, you know, the thinking of one of the principals who's involved at the firm and largely represents, you know, a thought experiment more than anything else.
And for the benefit of the accredited investors and qualified purchasers in the audience, you can also find information about the funds that Mike is involved in managing there at logicafunds.com. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Run your operations like a well-oiled machine with SS&C EZ. Automate daily tasks, eliminate manual processes, and minimize risk. SS&C EZ has been providing award-winning solutions backed by unparalleled client service for over 25 years. Today, they're helping 1,900 hedge funds, family offices, and asset managers transform their investment process and grow their business. SS&C EZ delivers cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to maximize efficiencies across the entire investment process for all asset classes. Their solutions are easy to use with friction-free integration into your downstream systems. Meet investor, regulatory, and due diligence requirements, all while lowering cost of ownership. Set your business up for rapid growth and download their free guide at ezsoft.com/macro. That's ezsoft.com/macro.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Mike Green back on the show. And particularly, it was nice to focus just on the cryptocurrencies with him.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you put it that way. I don't focus on that at all. What I focus on is the coming digital currency revolution that is going to completely reshape the face of finance. I think the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are going to play a fairly small role, although still an important role, in that overall story. And what I think this is really about is in the next 25 years, we're going to see a revolution where all fiat currencies, conventional currencies, are replaced by digital currencies. And I should draw a distinction, Patrick, because some people will say, well, isn't the financial system already digital? It's all been digital for 30 years. No, it really hasn't been. We've used digital accounting systems to keep track of conventional currency. There's a big difference between digital bearer instruments, where you can actually transmit value over a computer network, as opposed to sending checks and ledgers and IOUs over the computer network, which is what we've been doing for 30 years. And there's some very important distinctions in terms of disintermediation and counterparty risk inherent to that change. So it really is important. And eventually we're going to see financial markets, whether it be stock markets, commodity futures markets, bond markets, all markets will eventually be tokenized and re-architected on this completely new technology platform, which is emerging, of decentralized finance. So I think it's really, really incredibly important. So the thing that I really want people to take to heart is, look, there's going to be a digital currency revolution where we replace the existing currencies of the world with digital currencies. Now, the Bitcoin maximalists like to believe that that means it's a fait accompli that for sure Bitcoin is going to become the currency that replaces everything. I think that's very foolish thinking. A much more rational statement would be, we're going to have a competition like no competition you've ever seen before. People are all going to figure out that there is a race for who controls the digital currency that's going to replace the conventional US dollar at the center of the global financial system. And I think there's going to be a combination of central bank digital currencies vying for those roles, and there will be a space race of different countries, each wanting their digital currency to become the predominant digital currency that replaces the US dollar as the world's global reserve currency. The cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum will be trying to promote themselves as becoming real currencies in the global financial system. Some people are more optimistic that they'll succeed in that than I am. But the point is, understand, we don't know the outcome yet. There's going to be a race for who controls the currencies, and there's also going to be a race for the redesign of financial markets in this decentralized finance model. We know the big picture that we're going to digital currency and tokenized financial markets. We don't know who's going to be in charge. We can just try to identify who the apparent early movers are and who potentially is going to have a role. So I think the central bank issued digital currencies, just because governments have the ability to force their use, are likely to seriously challenge Bitcoin and Ethereum and the other cryptocurrencies. And I also anticipate that Silicon Valley digital currencies, along the lines of what Facebook began with Libra, will try to compete for that eventual role of who gets to replace the US dollar at the center of the global financial system. It's going to be a very interesting time. And contrary to what a lot of our listeners seem to think, I really don't have anything against Bitcoin. Bitcoin will always have a role as an alternative to government-issued currency. It's the people who think that it's a certainty that Bitcoin is going to become the center of the global financial system that everybody uses for everything that I think are frankly deluded in their thinking. It's much more likely that a government-sponsored digital currency system will replace the US dollar as the world's global reserve currency, and Bitcoin will continue to exist as an alternative to government money for as long as it's allowed to exist and to whatever extent that it is not regulated out of having a useful purpose, which is still a very real possibility. And for reasons I don't want to spend time going into, the business that you'll hear about how it can't be outlawed or it was designed to be impossible to outlaw it is just plain nonsense. The people who think that really haven't done their homework. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to this week's post-game chart book, which is titled Exuberant Markets. Talk about an understatement with this week's stock market action. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, then by all means, go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, sign up for it by clicking the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, chart two, Bitcoin versus US dollar. Well, boy, that's a little bit of a scary looking, maybe the beginning of a blow-off top. What do you make of this chart?
Well, you know, I think back to when we were doing our episode of Macro Voices back in late 2017, early 2018, when we had the original top. And one of the things I shared with listeners at the time was that when things go into their parabolic phase, where everything is so frothy and everything is just going up at thousands of points every single day, the one thing that the market inevitably has a date with is some sort of mean reverting correction. It's just gravity takes over something that's going up that quickly. And what we have is a scenario where we have the exact deja vu of that. I mean, through late 2020 into this first few weeks of January, Bitcoin went full on parabolic. And this is, we don't even have to have an opinion as to whether the merits of Bitcoin itself, just purely the technicals and the behavior of price. And this applies to any and every market that goes into the same type of a parabolic rise. And one thing we were just asking and over the last 2 weeks was, when do we finally see the blow-off tops in both Bitcoin and in the case Tesla? And I think it's very important to identify, because I think it will shift sentiment that could actually ripple into the broad markets. And I think that they're sort of like the generals of this bull market. And what's interesting is, even though Tesla has stalled, and I don't have the chart of Tesla here, it hasn't really begun correcting. But Bitcoin, on the other hand, has. And we've already seen a considerable correction. But what was the big warning sign to me was not that it had that three-day market correction where we saw Bitcoin, you know, drop. There was that 20% down day that it had in just one day from top to bottom of the move. But I always say it's not about the sell-off, but whether or not the bulls are capable of breaking it to higher highs. And what we had was a rally back towards 40,000, and they failed to break it to higher highs, and we're right back down to those lows that we saw several weeks ago. And this is now showing the behavior of distribution. And what I circled there in red, if we go to page 3 and page 4, where I have the circles, you see a similar style pattern, which is, once the parabolic rise finished, there's a second attempt to rally and break to a higher high. And when it fails, it turns and begins a distribution cycle. And we saw that back in 2019 in the summer, and we saw it again in 2000 and the original top, big top, which was the 2017-2018 peak. And each time Bitcoin began a considerable and quite deep mean reverting correction of its excesses. And I just asked the question, have we just seen the short-term high in Bitcoin? And I mean, at this point, it's using the analog of those, it really does look like the same type of pattern. And it'll be really interesting for us to track in the next couple of weeks whether that analog continues to develop that way.
Well, Patrick, there's also some fundamental news that has affected this tape. So let's talk about this next. And I'll go back to page 2 in the slide deck, where we're looking at the current move. As you say, there was just a parabolic rise that was due for a blow-off top anyway. So this could be just a technical move. But the thing that occurs to me is, what might have brought about that sudden reversal where it was just straight up to straight down? Well, that happened about 4 or 5 days before Christine Lagarde made her comments that she basically was calling on all central banks to aggressively regulate Bitcoin. It makes me wonder if somebody had early access inside information that that was coming and started trading it. So that was something that was kind of a question in the back of my mind anyway. And sure enough, right around the time that Christine Lagarde actually made that statement, it became a sell the rumor, buy the news kind of event, where we started to rally again, and it seemed like the market wanted to recover. But then there was another very sudden reversal to the downside that just happened in the last week or so. Well, what might be driving that? The news that's come out, and frankly, I don't follow cryptocurrency stuff that closely, so I'm a little bit out of my lane here, Patrick, but I do want to provide our listeners with at least some background information as to what's going on. You can draw your own conclusions. The news that's come out has been an analysis, and there was a couple of articles that have been published where people have said, look, what has been driving this huge rally in Bitcoin over the last several weeks as we've doubled in price? It's not Bitcoins being purchased in US dollars or being purchased in Korean won or being purchased in Japanese yen or euros. It's Bitcoins that have been purchased with Tether, with another cryptocurrency. Okay, what is Tether? Tether is a stable coin. The sales pitch for Tether says what that means is that it is backed. Every single Tether token is backed by a US dollar that is on deposit in a bank. Therefore, it is basically guaranteed that that stablecoin, hence the name stablecoin, will always be redeemable for $1 worth of value. It's supposed to track the value of the US dollar so that it doesn't go up and down in price, but it's a reliable store of value because it's backed one-to-one by good old-fashioned US dollars on deposit. That's the sales pitch. The internet rumor mill, and of course the internet rumor mill is subject to its own forms of manipulation, but what people are starting to allege, and I frankly have no way of verifying or, you know, proving or disproving this, is that Tether is a giant Ponzi scheme. They supposedly have backing dollar for dollar. Every token has a dollar behind it on deposit. Where is it on deposit? Is it Chase Manhattan? Is it Citibank? No, it's Deltek Bank in the Bahamas. And everybody knows that financial scams never happen in the Bahamas. So the backing of Tether is dubious, to be sure. And people are starting to allege that what's going on here is Tether has been printed somehow where there's not really a dollar behind it. There's a whole bunch of essentially phony baloney monopoly money Tether that has been used to prop up the price of Bitcoin, and the scam has just been revealed. Now, I don't know whether any of that is true. The point is, that's the latest rumor that's circulating. There have been several articles written about this. Frankly, my position on cryptocurrency is I ignore all things crypto to the maximum extent possible. So I really have no idea whether Tether is a scam or Tether is completely legitimate and it's scammers that are saying it's a scam. I don't know. But I am convinced that what's going on is this fear, uncertainty, and doubt associated with Tether has resulted in this next knee-jerk down. The market's going to decide either whether that's a real problem or just a fantasy problem. And I think the real question is either Bitcoin moves to yet another fresh high in the next few weeks, or it's probably done for quite a while. So I don't think that the final tell is in. I'm leaning towards it's done for a while, but I think we need to wait out the next couple of weeks. As a technician, based on those fundamentals that I described, what would you say in terms of what are the signals that you watch for to get confirmation as to which way this thing is headed next?
Well, the pattern of distribution essentially is that all rallies now get sold. So there will be periods where we will see, you know, a $2,000, $4,000 rise, maybe even more. But the pattern that really shows that this has turned the tide is that every rally starts being sold and distributed as smart money is realizing that the gig is up and it really starts to make sure that they try to unload as much as possible at the highest prices they can. And so that one thing I'm going to just be watching is whether that pattern persists. Like there's still a chance that this is just a Fibonacci retrace and we find support above 30,000 and the bulls just find a new catalyst to lean on and break this thing to all-time highs. It's possible. And that's sort of the art of reading the tape and seeing how it develops. I think that we shouldn't see prices above like 36,000 if in fact this is a topping formation. Maybe a quick little poke above there temporarily, and then but if we stay below there, it's going to increase my conviction that that top is in.
And again, I have no way of knowing whether this Tether story is real or not real, but boy, if it is real and what's really been propping Bitcoin up has been purchases of Bitcoin with monopoly money that everybody assumed was backed one for one by US dollars, but it really wasn't, there could be quite a bit of downside if that is actually proven true. I have no idea if it is or it isn't, but it'll be interesting to watch to be sure.
Anyway, so moving on to page five, I just wanted to talk the S&P 500. We already in the last couple of weeks talked about the progressive rally of the S&P 500, but really that isn't where the bubble in equities is occurring, right? We were talking about those other sectors within the markets where all the parabolic rises are going. Even the auto industry is going through this huge parabolic rise at this moment. So the S&P is doing its crawl. There are targets up to 3,900, even one target that shows measures out to 4,000 on the upside on the S&P. And so there's room for the S&P to crawl higher here in the coming days and weeks. But what is amazing is just some of the warning signs that we're seeing that typically are associated with the froth that comes along a short-term market top or even an intermediate market top. And what is interesting is on page six, I have a chart of option activity. This one is a chart that was provided by Spot Gamma. Brent over there did a great job putting together this chart. And what this is showing is looking at the amount of options that are bought to open minus the ones that are sold to open. And so it's looking at how retail and institutional investors are positioning themselves with options. And the blue line is showing equity call options. And this ratio is making a fresh new high, which is showing that there is a lot of froth about buying call options and buying gamma to the upside of the market. So in general, you have all of this energy that's coming where dealers are going to have to literally be buying equity and futures in order to keep themselves delta neutral while all the call buyers continue to press the upside. But what is also interesting, which is circled in red, is the fact that for put options, we are now seeing that ratio has turned negative, which means there is a much more interest to sell options for premium to open than there is to buy those puts as insurance or protection from a market drop. And we saw this conveniently also below zero back in January, just a month before the market turned for the coronavirus decline crash. And we saw the same circumstances back in August before the last short-term market top. Now, there's no guarantee that this is going to lead to a market crash or some big liquidity event, but a lot of those characteristics that showed this kind of option activity along the last two highs is all here right now.
Patrick, you've got a couple more sentiment charts on page seven. What kind of sentiment are these things measuring?
The one on the left is the one we shared last week that Charlie McElligott had out there talking about just how the different readings at Nomura were at extreme sentiment. But there was an interesting chart that was put out that's put together by Haver Analytics and Citi Research. And it's the panic euphoria model, and that shows just how much froth is in there in terms of the 12-month forward return on investment. And what you can observe here is that we have now hit such a euphoric overshoot that we have now exceeded, based upon this calculation, the euphoria of at the 1999-2000 peak in the equity markets. I never thought we would see us reach these kind of euphoric levels, but here we are having exceeded them. And again, that doesn't guarantee that a market decline has to start imminently any day, but it really does show how everyone has really gone all in on this, and the belief that Yellen and the Fed will just continue to keep this party going with more and more liquidity to keep driving the trend. You know, I asked the question, what could possibly go wrong, Eric?
Well, I don't think there's any easy calls here, Patrick. You would think normally, you know, if you showed either one of us these charts, you know, 5 years ago and said, what if you got to a point where sentiment reached these extremes, even greater than 2000? You know, you'd say in a heartbeat, obviously, it's time to short the market. It's about to crash. It's way overdue. The thing is, we've never had a time in history when this kind of unprecedented central bank stimulus and monetary policy intervention was being contemplated. And if there's anything that the market's proven to me in the last 10 years, it's when they print enough money, it has to go someplace, and it usually goes into financial markets. So it seems totally crazy to think that the market still has a lot of upside left in it. But I don't dare short it, and I'm not frankly all that excited about being long either. I think it could go either way.
Well, one of the things where I'll push back a little bit on is if we move on to page 8, and it shows the margin debt and really how much the borrowing in the market has increased. And the reason, looking at how much margin is being utilized in the markets, why it's so important is that that's the part of a portfolio that is renting the upside. Because during a liquidity event or some pullback, often it's the margined parts of the portfolio that have to be liquidated, and it's forced selling that could draw and create that negative feedback loop that just feeds a market decline. And the fact that we are seeing, especially at these incredibly low interest rates, more and more investors continuously tapping margin to leverage up that upside, that is really, I would argue, the fuel that could create the volatility. Now, again, we don't need to be calling a bear market, and we don't have to be calling, you know, some devastating crash like a repeat of March of 2020. But whenever we have these types of excesses, if any trigger creates a sell cycle, the fact that we are so leveraged up and on margin and things like this in the broader market, that adds fuel to creating that very volatile correction that could happen on the other side.
Well, Patrick, we're going to need to leave it there for this week's episode. Listeners, if you want to follow Patrick's play-by-play on this, sign up for a free trial of Big Picture Trading. You can find the information on slide 9 of the deck or at bigpicturetrading.com. And this episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by SS&C EZ, delivering cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to optimize operational and investment alpha across the entire investment processes. Listeners, if you haven't yet taken advantage of a free subscription to our Research Roundup email newsletter, please do so. You can do that by clicking the red button that says Looking for the Downloads on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Patrick, tell them what they're missing in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Mike Green, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a recent Felder Report article on what the boom in fraud says about the current market environment, and a link to an article about the record Wall Street euphoria. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.